Hi, I'm Scott.
And I am Zach.
Welcome back to Learning Grounds.
Episode 5.
This week, we talked with Daniel. Daniel's a student in the Education Policy and Management cohort at the Harvard Graduate School of Education.
Our conversation with Daniel started with what he's learning in his microeconomics class. Then we discussed a little bit about what kinds of policy he'll take as he goes back to the classroom as a teacher. And finally, I challenged both Scott and Daniel to convince me that education is a public good.
By now, you probably know the rules. Once one cup of coffee between the three of us is finished, we all start with one. Then the conversation is over, so if you have a cup of coffee handy, sit down and stay tuned. Listen about what Daniel learned this week.
Thanks a lot. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Welcome to the conversation.
We're back this week.
We are back this week after a two-week hiatus.
That's right.
One was laziness and the other was spring break. So,
is there a difference?
Well, one of them is scheduled laziness,
right,
and the other one is just
improvised laziness.
Yeah. Excellent. So our coffee this week comes again. We've returned to Starbucks. I'm going to go ahead and say it.
Yeah.
Because last time I did a horrible job of not saying it.
Uh-huh.
I'm drinking my usual kind of blonde roast.
Yeah.
Scott, what do you have?
I have a medium roast coffee with two shots of hazelnut.
That's exciting.
And no cream this time.
And
which was also improvised.
Yeah.
Not planned.
I'll just speak for my coffee because I'm not even
You don't know what you have?
You don't know what you
have. Well, you have just a black you have exactly what I have
in a
different
cup.
You have the blonde roast. Which is their lighter roast. New to their market. And our guest is Daniel. Daniel, what program are you in? He asked him knowingly.
Education Policy and Management.
Outstanding.
Thanks for sitting down with us and having a cup of coffee.
Yeah, and participating in the first ambient noise version.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're listening and hear background noise, it's because we're sitting outside.
Yeah.
In what is maybe the last good day of for another week.
For another week.
It's supposed to get ugly.
Yeah.
Daniel, how's your week been?
Great, you know, recharged, rejuvenated after both the scheduled and unscheduled laziness.
What did you do, if anything, interesting over your spring break?
I went home. I found a, you know, return to, you know, Minneapolis to be lazy there rather than here.
Excellent.
It was wonderful.
Beautiful. Excellent
weather.
So you just got to chill out. You got to be.
Yeah, I didn't. I really didn't do much. How about you guys?
I was here. My mother came into town, which was very nice. She'd never been to the Boston-Cambridge area.
She is much shorter than you are.
She is significantly shorter than I am, yes.
I was surprised by pictures.
Were you?
Yeah.
I mean, my father was tall. He was about my height.
I don't know that I expected her to be a giant woman.
Right. but you were surprised
I
when
was
she
surprised
wasn't.
How diminutive she was.
Right, that's interesting. I think she'll appreciate that.
I'm sure she's grand in personality.
Yeah, oh, absolutely true.
I went down to Philly and visited my old school and saw my old students and some my former colleagues and just hung out. And then I went down to Washington and didn't do anything of real merit or value.
For career days?
No, I just went down.
You just went down
just
there?
For days.
Uh-huh.
For days.
Just
yeah.
For days.
Yeah.
No career at all. I got to do a site visit to a school, and I hung out in a preschool classroom.
Hmm.
And that was the most wonderful thing I think I've done. I mean, that still, I think, I'm going to count that as non-career related.
Right.
Because it was just one of the happiest places I think you can possibly be.
That's outstanding.
Because tiny little kids will just come up to you and just... If you aren't scary,
right,
and I wasn't
at that moment,
they will just, you can be their best friend right away. And this little girl came up to me, and we were sitting on the carpet because it was carpet time, and she just came up to me and she did the thing where she pulls on the sleeve, and she said, "Can I sit on your lap?" Because she'd run out of carpet squares. I was like, "Sure, totally." And then you know how like little kids can just like. It's like you're suddenly at peace all of a sudden.
Right, yeah.
And that was it. That was the highlight of my spring break.
That's fantastic.
I was just chilling with a bunch of little kids. We played dinosaurs and blocks. We built
them
houses. Because they need houses.
Yeah.
That's why they became extinct.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter what the event was. There was no...
Yeah. Or the houses were substandard.
That's true. Substandard houses. There was no code is
right.
The problem.
Right.
They all had houses, but
right.
No legislative arm.
Not enough fire.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Daniel, what have you been learning lately?
What have I been learning? It's It's been an interesting semester. I'm taking microeconomics, which is a sort of interesting perspective on educational issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking a history class. We're learning about the sort of foundations of teachers' unions in Chicago this week. It's been also interesting, enlightening.
Let me ask you about the microecon course.
Sure.
There's a loud explosion. I'm not sure how this is all going to sound.
It's going to be a fantastic experiment.
But is the microecon course, is it focused on kind of the budgeting around schools and education, or is it focused on kind of applying economic principles to the way we design education systems?
Mm-hmm. I think it's mostly I think thinking about education in terms of not just which programs simply engender the best results in terms of student achievement, but which ones make the most sense from a financial perspective. So it's sort of thinking, I mean, it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis applied to different educational programs. I mean, that's part of it. We've also talked about just the economics of the teacher labor market and that sort of thing. But
has anything changed your mind since you've been in the class? Has there been something that's been this moment of, oh?
Yeah, I think, like, for instance, talking about higher education, you know, we sort of talked about the reasons why institutions are able to sort of subsidize education for some but not others, which sort of seems inherently unfair, but really, we sort of, our professor sort of made a case for why it actually is more equitable, why when the universities sort of get to select who pays what, they actually end up being able to provide more for the people who can afford the least to come, so it often can seem unfair that from a consumer's perspective that I have to pay full price when you get to come here for free, and it's just an issue of financial aid, but actually those practices tend to sort of,
so it's closer to fairness but not equal, and
exactly.
And it's kind of our getting that misunderstood. I read something this last week about the possibility of colleges charging more higher tuition prices for courses that were more popular.
Oh really?
Yeah, that you would. If you want to take this class that everybody loves,
mm-hmm.
that'll be fine.
But it's going to cost you an extra.
But there will be a market rate applied to it.
Right.
That's
fascinating.
It is kind of. And there's this part of your brain, I don't know, there's a part of my brain that was, oh, that makes sense.
Right.
And then there was another part of my brain that thought, oh, that can go horribly
wrong. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, and then it engenders that also that moment of, if I'm the kid who doesn't have much of a scholarship, mm-hmm. or if I'm the kid who doesn't have much money going into this,
are you going to get shut out of the classes you want to take?
Exactly. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, shouldn't, once you make it into the institution, shouldn't it not matter after that?
Right.
Shouldn't
you have access to all the resources that are supposedly available at the institution?
Right. Like, you've decided to create a gap, an economic gap within higher education,
mm-hmm.
in a like another one. On top of those that exist already.
But again, I think, it sort of comes down to thinking about it in different ways, because I guess the flip side of the argument could also be that if they're able to charge more for the popular classes, depending on how they decide to, you know, set up their funding structure, they could theoretically take the extra money and then channel it back into the sort of programs that are traditionally underfunded, you know, because they don't
right.
have as much money. I mean, so if it's in the name of this larger, big picture of equity,
right.
you know, sometimes those can have benefits that are harder to see in the short term.
And do you think that happens? I mean, do you think that, is that where your judgment lies of, oh, this is the plan and this is what will happen? Or do you come on the cynical side of things of?
Yeah, I think that there's, from an economic perspective, it's hard to take out the personal interest side. I mean, it really is the study of personal interest, you know, like how much do I want to pay for this? How much, you know, how
uh-huh.
much, I think, It's hard to think about it in terms of equity terms when you're quantifying everything in terms of dollars and cents sometimes.
What do you think, and either of you, what would you say is, if you had to start building a funding model for education, if we gave you tabla rasa, right? you get to start from the beginning, what do you think is the place that we're not looking that we should be?
A very loaded question to ask any individual in the first place, I think, based on the fact that our biases towards particular programming are probably strong in certain
situations. I'm totally fine with that. I'm assuming that you are coming at this as humans.
Yeah, I mean, like, coming at it from my human perspective, like, I want and beyond just the things that I would like as a human, also the experiences I've had as a teaching professional, like seeing certain programs go underfunded, or seeing certain programs that in general, like on average in America, are underfunded, but in some places get really well funded, and seeing how successful those programs are. Like I would love to see the arts get less short shrift than it tends to. I think music's really important. I think the visual arts are really important. I think teaching, like having wood shop and different things like that, auto shop in particular, you know, these kinds of classes is really, really, really
important. The industrial arts,
yeah, thank you. I think it's really, really important. I think that if in education we want to have a conversation about the variety of learning modalities that exist, then we also have to kind of acknowledge that some people are going to their skills and talents are going to most lie in those sorts of courses.
So taking you back to the funding model then, mm-hmm. do you create a model that guarantees equal funding across, like, so let's say that a school says these are the types of courses we're offering.
Mm-hmm.
Do you say I guarantee equal funding to each type of course, and that if I reduce funding, I won't be cutting woodshop, but we'll be cutting a percent of funding from every course? Do you give them equal footing in that way?
I don't think it would be reasonable to be that simple with the model, although I don't pretend to know as much about it as most people do.
But I mean, from an idealist standpoint, I mean, let's say we're brainstorming ways to do things. Is that where you go?
Would I give equal treatment to all pro? I think. The first step would be to determine via somebody, like if I was to determine as God that a particular kind of programming had merit. Yeah, edugod. that a particular kind of program had merit. Like once we made that determination, right, then I would try to treat them, respect them equally in terms of funding.
Okay.
Whether that meant like giving them equal funding is kind of another question.
Well, I think it can't give them equal funding because that's not equity when you think about that something simply costs more. It just costs more to do a science lab than it does to do a music set. You know.
Well, to do music and science costs much more than English.
Right.
Right. So that's why you cut music first.
Right.
Because it gives you the most. You get to keep the most kids in classes and you get to save more money.
Right.
What about Daniel? How do you?
Well, I don't know I'm not quite sure what we're talking about. Are we talking about where the money comes, like, from the how much money, like, per pupil spend, or are we talking about, like, once that's in, like, where, how does that get apportioned?
However you want to come at the question. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think Scott's right. I think it's important to think about well-balanced education. I think what you can do is look at districts that do successfully implement arts and music programs, and you can, you know, benchmark, like, how are they spending their money, you know, which districts are doing the best job at providing, you know, quality education for the lowest price, and then try to replicate those models. I mean, I think that is important. But yeah, I think it's a kind of a question of where is the money going to come from.
Well, I have an idea on that one.
All right.
That's excellent.
And
is it a money tree?
It is a money tree. It's planted somewhere on campus.
That's what I thought.
That's actually what Harvard's endowment is made of. There's a tree.
There's a tree. And you've been keeping this a secret from us for all these weeks.
Well, if I tell you, I get killed.
Damn it.
No, but just kind of playing with and know that I'm thinking big and brainstorming and think that this would be an interesting idea is campaigns, political campaigns, mm-hmm. that a certain percentage of what they spend must be on education.
Hmm.
I don't know how that would work.
Right. I find this interesting.
But I'm thinking about where where is money?
Right.
And how could it be and so spending that could then be beneficial to the campaign.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because then you've done this thing and you've made policy in some sort of way.
Right.
And I don't know how that works, and it probably doesn't, but I think that kind of thinking could be an interesting way into a non-traditional way of funding things.
So I had a really interesting conversation with another colleague of ours who shall remain nameless because the conversation got a little bit heated. But we had had a conversation about the... this is kind of veering off this a little bit, but about human nature with regards to how people choose to spend their personal resources, whether it's mm-hmm. you know, capital or whatever. And for the purposes of this conversation, we can kind of talk about it in terms of capital. It was basically her opinion that the, you know, people make their own money in America, and they should be entirely allowed to choose how to spend that money. And not just that they should be entirely, you know, at their, it should be entirely their own choice, but that ultimately it's going to be their own choice. And that they would, if given that choice, choose to spend it on themselves. And perhaps their families, mm-hmm. you know, direct families. And she, you know, sort of advanced this argument about how given this model, people are essentially going to be spending on private education
right.
in a lot of circumstances, just mm-hmm. because they get to choose directly.
Because that money goes to their kids.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly, directly. Mm-hmm. And they dig that. Not only that, they... In certain occasions get to have a little bit of a measure of control as to the way that the service is provided, you know, that they're paying for, things like that. And the reason this was a conversation amongst a variety of people, and the reason it got heated was because there was another person in the conversation who entirely disagreed that model was ethically acceptable.
Mm. Yeah, and I... Right? Yeah, and those arguments kind of make themselves in the telling of the one case. There's this moment of, well, yeah, but
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Daniel,
do you mean that no one would pay taxes?
That seems like
a very prominent first step of,
yes.
of putting that forward,
right? That no one would pay taxes because the money that you would pay in taxes would not necessarily be under your own control in terms of choosing to spend
it. It wouldn't necessarily go to things that would benefit you directly,
right?
Okay, well, let's do that then. I can see no reason that is not okay.
Well, I think what's interesting is I think in this country in particular, we have a strong history of public education. I think that the collective imagination, I think it sort of contradicts whatever your colleague said, because I think generally people do think of public education as a public good that people really, by and large, support. I mean, people, I think no matter who you ask, for the most part, will say... they support the public education system. They'll all give you different ideas about what needs to be fixed, but mm-hmm. I think, in general, people don't complain about spending money, even tax money, on public education. I think they generally complain about how it gets spent or where it goes, or some people will say...
So I'm fine with funding public education, I'm just not okay with how public education is run.
Right. I think that's what most... I mean, I think most people wouldn't say they'd rather pay for private education. I don't know, I think that this country has a sort of unique relationship with public education, and I think people tend to support... for it.
Because they support it as a public good.
Yeah.
But do you think that there's a sentiment of it as a public good? Like,
I could be wrong. I think that, like, maybe by and large that might be true, but I think there's a lot more variation in that than I want to believe. You know, like, I think that a lot of people think that the money that goes to public education is wasted because public education is messing up so badly that what may once have been a public good, or the spirit in which the you know, enterprise is kind of pursued, is like not counterbalancing how badly it's performing, the system is performing.
Okay, let me stop for a second and just, can you guys convince me that public education is a public good?
Well, I do.
That was the question I wanted to ask.
I do want to say that I think you may be right on one hand, but I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance, because I also think that the fact that we have free public education, it's a critical part of the larger narrative that people tend to believe, you know, or you know, ascribe to America, which is that anybody can get an education, anybody can succeed, anybody can do anything. And if mm-hmm. we don't, that's a fundamental component to that, because if you say that everyone needs to pay for it, you're shutting
people out of the American dream,
right? And I think you're right. I think that's ideology. I think practically most people would also say that it's a broken system and doesn't, you know, really serve kids very well, and it's totally lost its you know, yeah. bearings. And it's too test focused and not focused enough on, you know, well-rounded education. But
I really want to explore this question of whether or not public education, or I want to explore whether or not we can ascribe that anything is a public good or what a public good is.
Well, I'm curious about education. Just to
yeah,
argue for me. Uh-huh. I will argue against. but argue for me that public education is a public good. This is both of you, so don't look just to him, Daniel.
Knowledge in life increases. I'm just gonna riff. Knowledge in life increases probably survival rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just generally have more survival methods. The more you know, survival rate leads to longer lifespan, leads to more people. I'm throwing a lot of stuff out the window, but I don't know, public good.
So yes, I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
I would also say, I mean, haven't we had a couple of studies recently that have said the majority of learning that people do in their lives is outside of the formal environment, that school doesn't account for. I think I would be generous in saying that they have found that like schooling counts for 20% of the learning we do in our lives.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, there's this moment of knowledge in life is good.
Right.
I don't know that I'm necessarily sold on the idea that public school is giving me that knowledge.
But that's not the same question. That's not the question of whether it's a public good. That's a question of where the learning comes from. I mean,
right.
To the sense that it's a public good, we know that societies that are well educated tend to have, you know, that tends to be correlated with a lot of positive factors such as life expectancy, you know, child mortality. I think generally what are considered universal signifiers of, you know, societal success.
Right.
High literacy rates. And to that extent, I mean, we know that education is important. We know that people who are educated live longer, tend to be happier, tend to, you know, have happier families. I mean, it's just, I think that those sorts of things are generally trends. And I think as a society, we value those things. And we know that education is correlated with them, so I think, to that extent, it's a public good. It's directly tied to, you know, the success of society. And it doesn't. You could learn nothing. That you could totally exclude learning from that model. I could say that theoretically, you don't have to learn anything in school. By going through the motions for some reason, by participating in those structures, you know. Something happens.
So not necessarily learning in school.
It doesn't, no.
But the going to school.
Well, I would say learning does happen. I think that's an important part of it. But I'm saying I don't think that's not what makes it a public good necessarily.
Okay. We just know that by some alchemical process, compulsory attendance of school by the populace leads to these things. And since it does.
So is it the training of the game? Like the learning of...
A part of it is certainly learning how to just participate in the...
Stand in a line, sit where you're supposed to, raise your hand.
Absolutely. Because you have those sorts of things, you know, and creativity is important too, but there is for societal cohesion, you do need to sort of condition people to behave in society in a certain way. I mean, that's not a value judgment that's right or wrong, but it certainly is important if you want to have a society that sort of has
you need norms.
Values. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think in order to have, for a lot of the systems that we've built now, at the very least, to function the way they function, you do need to be able to kind of fall within a range of behaviors in certain circumstances, you know. So standing in line might be an example of that, you know, or just things like exchange. So, you know, if you're going to have some good or service that you're going to request of somebody, you know, you're going to need to exchange something for that. Usually it's money, but I mean, it could be some kind of trade. And we introduce kind of a lot of those ideas on a theoretical level, but also sort of on a behavioral level, I think, in schools.
Okay.
I would guess.
All right. I hear you. So I'm going to change subject now. Daniel, you're in education policy and management. What is the goal? What is the...
My goal?
Yeah, what like, or immediate goal, not in, like, what's your 5 and 10 year plan?
I'm seriously considering teaching next year. That's sort of right now my plan, to go back and teach second grade in Minneapolis next year.
Because the little kids are awesome.
I do enjoy, teaching the little kids.
And you were elementary teacher before?
First grade, yep.
Yeah.
So,
What inspired you to pursue an EPM degree after being a teacher?
I think I got carried away with the romanticization of policy as a sort of cure-all for the larger systemic issues that affected my students.
Mm-hmm.
But since being here, I actually felt like policy is sometimes an unhelpful abstraction from the day-to-day lives of students. And
say a little bit more about that.
I just really miss the interaction. I miss the success. I miss being a part on a day-to-day basis of students' lives. And I think I'm interning at the state right now and at BPS, and those are both sort of abstract policy positions, which are interesting from an intellectual standpoint, but I really don't feel connected to the students, even though theoretically that's who I'm serving in both of those functions.
So is it kind of an immediacy of the return on your actions?
It's immediacy on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's knowledge that I'm actually doing something that's helping kids.
Okay.
Whereas the policy level, you're always... Oh, this is going to get me in trouble.
No one really knows
I'm
who
not
you
saying
are.
That... I'm
no
not,
one also, really listens to the podcast.
Yeah. Sure, I know.
My mom might be upset.
I think that policy is a risky game because you can say you know what the outcomes are going to be, but you don't. You can change the rules, but you're playing with kids' futures, and to some extent you need to do that when you have a broken system. You need to change how things are going and experiment with fixing them, but along the way, we've been trying to really fix education for... since the late 80s.
Right.
And we really haven't made a lot of progress. And along the way, we've, left a lot of kids behind. And I think that's the failure of policy to some extent and the frustration of policy. And, I think you never quite know that you're doing something right until it all... You really have to have a long-term view. Maybe I'm just impatient.
Or you never quite know that you've done something horribly, horribly wrong.
Right.
Until you get to the long-term view, right? I mean, but in the classroom, you can make that adjustment.
On the fly.
Almost immediately.
And you really don't do things in the classroom that are horribly wrong. You do plenty of things
wrong.
Moderately wrong. But,
right. But things you can kind of fix the next day.
You tend to not feel like you're really, messing kids up.
What was your teaching experience like? Oh man!
Well, it was an interview with Steve Jobs last week, or no, this past week, and he's talking about making change, and he's saying that you change a course of event the closer you are to the vertices
mm-hmm.
of the events, the greater your impact will be. Right? If you wait until it gets too far out. Then it's gone so far awry, then you can't do it. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some of that is kind of recollected in your point of kind of in the policy realm. There's the I hope that this makes it to helping kids learn better.
Right, and you do, and I think policy is really important for that because I think that's what it does. I mean, right. In theory, and it is important. The systemic, domain counts for a lot. It's just I don't know if it's. It's harder to see the results.
So, that said, you're going in with this pretty intense master's degree in policy, and going back into the classroom. How does that change who you are and how you work as a teacher?
Well, I think my kind of goal now is to think about school leadership, and so I think I'm gonna go back into the classroom with an eye on school leadership. I think that's a policy, a realm of policy that's just as important as any other policy. How do you What are the policies of your school? What's the culture? What are your desired outcomes? And I think I'm feeling more and more like that's the level of policy that I'm most concerned about.
And do you feel like your practice will be shifted after this year? Like your day-to-day operations
mm-hmm.
and working with little kids? And how?
I might have to defer on that for a little bit. I'll have to think about that.
Okay. this isn't just at the tip of your
So... kind of along that vein, I cite another conversation that I had with somebody recently. We were discussing how certain of our elected officials are in very high positions in the U.S. government who are in the education sector. And some of those officials have no experience as teachers, as practitioners on the ground. So there's that separation between kind of practice and policy. They know about policy. They don't really know about practice. In your opinion, does that make them ineffective leaders in our work?
No, I mean, I wouldn't say ineffective because it's hard to know who they're surrounded with, where they're getting information. But I do think it's a major deficit when you're making decisions that ultimately, the ultimate effect of those decisions is the classroom. I mean, that's what education policy is. It doesn't, it affects every layer along the way, but it, you know, the classroom is the final frontier of that. And I think it would be really hard to really be able to envision your own impact if you couldn't really envision what it was like to be in a classroom every day.
And I would add to that, I think that it makes it more difficult to find an audience with those for whom you are making policy, mm-hmm. and whom you propose to lead. I think that teachers, by and large, have great difficulty listening to someone who has not had that classroom experience, for right or for wrong, right?
Right.
Because it doesn't necessarily mean the ideas are
right.
worse or better.
Right.
Because we know that outside thinking oftentimes sees problems in much better and clearer ways.
Yeah.
But I think that just for me as a classroom teacher to think that I would have a leader who had not spent time in the classroom would be very difficult mm-hmm. to come around to the idea of, oh, you do have a decent enough idea of what my day is like. Like, and even if that leader was just a principal, if my principal had no classroom teaching experience,
yeah,
I think I would have a great deal of difficulty, at least initially, mm-hmm. unless I really got to know the person, mm-hmm. following their lead.
Yeah.
Especially on something that seemed counterintuitive
yeah.
to what I knew or what I believed to be the right thing for students and teachers.
Another question. I'm interested, we talked about the fact that success is kind of, in our minds, is probably going to be measured over the long term with regards to these sorts of things, and maybe we're just impatient, and that's kind of what our problem is, and we don't see it over the short term, so we're a little bit upset. How would we define in our work, the education sector, how would we define success briefly?
This one's not at the tip of your tongue. I'm gonna steal the answer from my last principal and very good friend, and he said that the outcome that he wished for every student was that they were thoughtful, kind, thoughtful, wise, passionate, and kind, and that if you've done that or moved children closer to that, then you've done the right thing.
I think it was Justice Powell who said of pornography that he didn't know how to define it, but he knew it when he saw it. And I think that's sort of how teachers see success. It's sort of a mix of things that you can't always articulate or delineate, but you do know it when you see it. And especially if you've taught for more than a couple of years, you know when you're improving at it, even if you can't quite put your finger on what it is.
Mm-hmm. And this is not the first time I've heard someone here, not even the second time I've heard someone here make that comparison of what good teaching or what learning looks like, and the pornography quote. And I just think that it is amazing, and that those two lie. And they've always said it to a room full of people, and everybody's like,
yeah.
And nobody seemed to be that struck by the irony of the conversation. That's where we've gotten to.
But it's a great quote. I mean, it sort of really sums up that
intangible quality.
Right.
So then, what do you say to the people who are the Gates Foundation projects that are being funded all over the country right now, and like, we're going to come up with this checklist, mm-hmm. we're going to watch these, and kind of headed by people on this campus,
right,
whose offices are around us right now.
Yeah,
we're going to find this. They're going to find these things, and we're going to, and that way you'll know how to evaluate a teacher.
Right, and we're going to measure them too, based on particular methods.
Right. So what did I mean? That doesn't really jive with.
But it does. I think it's a question of multiple measures. And if your kids are doing well on tests, and your peers are reviewing you well, and your principals are looking at you with a kind of a holistic rubric, and you know, in a supportive way, sort of thinking about are you teaching effectively? Are you reaching your kids? I think it is a question of looking at things from a number of different perspectives. But I think you're right. Like, the checklist doesn't work, but at some point, you know, I think you can sort of tell when someone's getting a lot of positive feedback from it, you know, along these different dimensions, that there is effective teaching going on.
Let's see.
Except, when you are in a toxic environment, or you are in a school that is built that does those things, right? That you've got your principal, you've got your colleagues, and your kids are doing well on tests. Right? Everything is on board, and you're moving in the right direction. And I, as an outsider, come and look at and see the way you are treating children, and realize, oh, wait a minute, this is not ethically sound. This is not morally sound, right? And there are schools that are doing those things. Right?
I would just hope that if your peers are reviewing you and your superiors, you know.
But if you're working in that environment, then everybody's kind of bought into the idea that this is how this
and
is
those
how we
places
work
do
with
exist.
Kids.
That's true,
right? I mean, and so where's the if we open it up to the market, mm-hmm. right? And then these things get footing in a way that isn't necessarily.
That's true. I mean, it's hard to come to a conclusion on this issue. I think what's one of the things that we will grapple with as we move forward is the fact that. The way that we measure success is really, really assorted, and there are these like many, many lenses through which we choose to measure success. And most of the people whose offices surround us have picked like a sort of narrow set of things to kind of focus on because they have one life to live and not enough hours in the day. And many students on our campus, because they've become associated with a particular program or whatever it may be, many students on our campus, I would say probably myself included, have chosen, you know, a sample of those measures on which to focus, right? There's that, you know, classic saying of like every teacher thinks their subject is the most important. Right? I wonder how we come to a space where instead of, you know, being convinced of the superiority of a particular model, like I know students on this campus who are convinced that the answer lies in statistics. And if we can just build enough really good multiple regression models, we're going to find it, you know, or, you know, and like I think many people have come to maybe came to school with a little bit what they now perceive as a naive perspective about like, well, policy is the way to solve it, you know, issues in the classroom, or if we just figure out what the MRIs are saying about the human brain, then we're going to figure it out, right?
Well, so then the easy answer here, mm-hmm. and it does seem to me to be quite easy. Mm-hmm. Everybody's office is next to somebody else's office.
Right, right.
Right, I mean, literally.
Yeah.
And yet, I see very little conversation going on across programs, mm-hmm. both in students and in professors, right? There's very, like, I can tell you a time when I saw a professor sit and watch another professor teach.
You can't?
No. Right? And this, mm-hmm. but this is a practice mm-hmm. that I've heard many professors and students say needs to be happening in K-12 schools, right?
Right.
Teachers should be observing their peers and having conversations about that.
Right.
But it's not something that I see happening
at the level here
in this particular, like, and mm-hmm. so there's no modeling of expectations, which we would probably all agree is what should happen in successful learning environments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling all these people who are going out to be teachers or school leaders or policy makers,
do as I say, not as I do,
right? But then you also have the students who should be at least a little meta about it.
Mm-hmm. One would hope.
Also not making those kind of cross program, like the arts and education, mind, brain, and education,
mm-hmm.
And then school leadership. Those folks should be meeting all the darn time.
I don't know. Like, a lot of my friends are the arts and ed kids, and I'm an MBE kid, so
well, yeah,
I'm just special.
Arts and the brain.
but I'm a terrible MBE kid, that's for sure.
Right.
That's the other thing. So.
And Daniel and I are in the same program, and we don't talk that often. But that's just mainly because he never responds to my emails. That's not true.
I can't blame
him. That's not
true. I just, you know.
Wow, I write good emails.
Yeah.
And as the conversation has digressed, so has my
cup of coffee. Oh, mine too.
But I want to come back to the question that you said you were going to defer. And it was the question of how your practice may shift. And if you don't have an answer right now, that's also
I don't
cool.
know.
I just wanted to give you a chance.
I don't know practically how it'll change. I know it'll be different because I'm going to be going back with a really different
knowledge set.
Yeah, it's not, and it's a knowledge set, but it's also, my feelings have changed. I've come to really believe that the classroom is the focal point for, mm-hmm. you know, real change. And I think,
Are you guys like in a meeting?
We're just doing the podcast.
Just doing the podcast. Oh. Whatever. Yeah. That's live. That's live right there, folks.
You'll never know who it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So your feelings have changed.
I think I feel more empowered as an educator.
Okay.
Now that I think I've experienced the limits of policy to some extent.
So you know that, is it a feeling of almost the more is riding on your shoulders?
Yeah, to some extent.
All right. Well, my cup of coffee is over. Daniel's getting a phone call.
He's getting a phone call. We were trying to be subtle about it, but no, that was just...
I just decided.
Yeah.
Since we're outside.
Yeah. Throw him under the bus. Why not?
So, Scott.
Yeah. Zach, tell me.
What have you learned this week?
You know, I was imagining you were going to ask that question.
I don't know how you figured that out. You know me so well.
I know. I've learned a variety of things this week. I wrote...
Tell me one of them, won't you?
You know, I this is a really kind of interesting one. So I arrange for the Class Notes a cappella group. It's the Hugsy a cappella group.
They're quite good, Daniel. Have you seen them perform?
I have seen them, yes, at the holiday party.
Oh, that's fantastic. I would also like to comment on Zach's MC skills. Fantastic. Just stellar.
I'm available for all your corporate parties.
Yeah. And I wrote another arrangement of a song. And I will not go into the theory details, but I learned, based on doing it, some particularly complicated chord structures and how to write them down, which I wouldn't otherwise have known.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So that I learned this week.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Daniel, do you have your... What have you learned this week? What's a thing you've learned?
What have I learned? What have I learned? That's a really good question.
Do you want some time to think about it while I say what I learned?
Yes.
All right. Mine is super... duper nerdy.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of Battlestar Galactica.
You were. Mm-hmm. We know that because you've made some references.
I've made a Starbucks, yes. Starbucks reference before. I just watched Caprica, which existed for a season on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yeah.
And I learned this week that there was another series that they were planning.
Uh-huh.
Also, it was happening between Caprica and Battlestar. They made the pilot. It's going to air as a 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
But then they have decided to pass on the creation of the series.
Oh.
And I learned that today.
That's...
Or not today, but this last week. And it was a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, that's kind of a bummer thing to learn. Particularly for the sci-fi nerds amongst us.
I am one of them.
Yeah, I am too. I am too, so you're in decent company.
Yeah, but that's what I learned. Nothing huge.
Yeah, nothing huge.
No intricate chord progressions.
Hey.
But still, important information.
I think so.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, first of all, I want to apologize for taking the phone call. Sometimes it was somebody who I'm waiting to hear from a job offer.
Well.
So one of those things. Where
that would have been
this
great.
This time
we could
of
have
year,
captured that.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. No. If somebody calls me, I will just bolt out of here if it comes to a job.
Yeah. It was. I think he missed dial because I already talked to him this morning.
Oh.
Yes.
I was very excited for a minute, but then he didn't really. He wasn't there, so it wasn't as fruitful as I hoped, but.
Well, I'm sure that it will be
thank you.
Point.
I think I learned this week. I'm doing a paper for one of my classes, a history class, about the Chicago Teachers Union. And I was really interested to learn that even though the union in Chicago never really spent a lot of sort of concerted effort on social reform and making, you know, improving conditions for black teachers and for female teachers, there was the fact that they had these large factions of black teachers and female teachers calling for reforms within the unions ended up sort of incidentally bringing about a lot of really positive change that even though the union wasn't specifically fighting for, it sort of occurred because people were making their voices heard. And it just made me, it's sort of an empowering thought to think that the unions, you know, didn't, they may not have had, you know, they may not have been fighting for, you know, what were important changes, but the teachers still have a really important role to play in this, in the process too. And I think that's been something, you know, a good thing to think about, especially in the EPM program, where I think there's sometimes a lot of, you know, rhetoric around unions. And I think that's what I learned.
Cool.
Outstanding.
Well, mine seems pretty crappy right now. I'm still going to hold on to it. It's important to me.
I think you should.
All right. Well, that is another episode of Learning Grounds.
I'm Scott.
I'm Zach.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Learning Grounds with Scott and Zach. Our intro music comes from New Dance Boys Mission. It's called Intro, and it's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Learning Grounds is also under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Say it three times fast. And thanks for listening. Thank you.